Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hi, this is Dr. Suzanne Kuda. I am meeting today with Dr. Valerie O'Hara. We are going to be discussing obesity in the child today. We're going to start with introductions first. I am a pediatrician by training and an adolescent medicine specialist. I'm a master fellow of the OMA and a fellow of the AAP, and I'm certified in obesity medicine from the American Board of Obesity Medicine. I run my own private practice in San Antonio, Texas, where I concentrate on children, but also see adults. I have had experience in the field of obesity medicine for about 15 years at this point. Val, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. It's great to be here with you, Dr. Kuda. I am also a pediatrician, and I'm also FOMA, a fellow of the Obesity Medicine Association and the fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I've been working in Maine for 27 years with a focus in obesity that began in 2005 and started my clinic in 2009. I focus all on children up to the age of 21. In the state of Maine in a multidisciplinary clinic currently at Maine Health, the Weight and Wellness Clinic.
Okay, fantastic. So today we're going to be talking about obesity in the child, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to define that first. First of all, I'd like to say that the basis of this discussion is from our clinical practice statement on obesity in the child. And that is to differentiate it from a previous clinical practice statement that we did, which was obesity in the adolescent. So for this particular discussion, we are talking about a child between the ages of 2 to 12 years old. That is the definition. When we say child, we mean 2 to 12 years old for the purposes of our CPS, our clinical practice statement, and for this podcast. Now for our definitions of obesity that we're going to be using when we're talking about this for the rest of the podcast. And that would be to define what we call overweight, which would be greater than the 85th percentile, followed by obesity, which is greater than the 95th percentile, and then severe obesity, which is greater than or equal to 120% of the 95th percentile. Those are the common definitions used when we're classifying children for obesity. And there are further classifications that go into degrees of severe obesity, but for the purposes of this discussion, I think it's enough to just say that severe obesity is those children greater than or equal to the 120% of the 95th percentile. Now, in terms of background, the children in the age group we're discussing, the 2 to 12 age group, this is a demographic in which obesity is becoming more and more of a serious problem. It's been increasing in prevalence. Now up to 20 to 21% of our children meet the criteria for overweight or obesity. And those numbers are higher in Black and Hispanic children. And in those children who have overweight or obesity, there's a comorbid condition in 39% or more of those children. So you can see that not only are they affected, but they're suffering from suffering from diseases. Dr. O'Hara, do you have anything to comment on that?
I agree. I think sadly what we've been seeing over the last decade is that is the fastest growing subset, that severe obesity class 2 and 3 that you're talking about. And in an additional study that we do mention in our CPS, in an Italian study of preschool children, that percentage was even higher. Up to 88% of those children had at least one comorbidity. And in our own smaller study that we conducted in my clinic, published in 2017, which included children as young as 3, it was roughly 400 patients, all of them had at least one comorbidity, 94%. So the idea of these children presenting younger and younger with significant pathology really highlights the need for our CPS.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we all know, those of us in this field, that it's alarming, seriously alarming, how many children come in at these young ages. And I think another thing to keep in mind is what will happen. You know, a lot of these kids aren't referred early, and they aren't or aren't referred at all, which is a shame, because by the time they are referred, we're way behind the power curve. And I think it's significant to remember that these children with obesity have a high likelihood of growing up to be adults with obesity. In fact, 56% of children with obesity become adults with obesity. And with those children who have severe obesity, 80% become adults with obesity. So, you know, just hoping that things are going to turn out well, it's not a plan. And I think that these children really deserve the attention that we're trying to bring to this important matter. So Dr. O'Hara, let's start by discussing how we've been managing these children with obesity and what the expected outcomes are with our current management.
Sure. I think for the longest time, and continuing now with the most recent AAP CPG clinical practice guideline that came out in the fall of last year, we continue to build on the foundation. A sort of cornerstone of therapy has been in the past primarily limited to intensive health behavior lifestyle therapies, primarily because we didn't have a lot of anti-obesity medications to consider or to use, particularly in this younger child population. So that continues to be what we talk about. And when we say that, this typically focuses on health education, skill building, particularly around dietary education, physical activity, and movement across the lifespan. What the CPG does mention is starting as early as possible. When you see it, we should be treating it and doing it intensively. Again, pulling in, they mentioned the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, which just recently had its most recent update. In that assessment, it recommends at least 26 contact hours longitudinally over a 3 to 12 month period, utilizing all of these multifactorial team members, addressing the whole child, the family, considering social stressors and the environment. What we do know that this is somewhat difficult. There are challenges that we've seen over time for those of us who've been doing this for a long time that has been continuing what we continue to offer families, but there's a problem with access, particularly for those children who are living rurally, for example, to have access to a multidisciplinary center, and even within their community bases. Not all rural communities even have a YMCA, for example, that you could partner with. So that is an ongoing challenge, and there is data that shows that those children who live rurally are at actually higher risk for obesity and the complications that are associated with obesity. Financial sustainability of these high intensity programs, again, become a problem, and that we know there's continued high attrition. Asking providers to make that available and for families to be able to attend to that many touch points continues to be a challenge. And there was an interesting paper that came out in 2021 by Smith et al. That considered the ethics of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines when it's a very difficult time points to implement and to continue across the time. And we know, as you said, Dr. Koo, this is a chronic disease that progresses. This is something that we're going to ask families to do ongoingly. And how sustainable is that? And when we think about that, we need to also consider, and I'm sure we'll talk about, what are those outcomes of intensive lifestyle behavior therapies alone versus combining them with anti-obesity medications, as we've had more of those become available since the prior U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guideline, for example, in 2017. So I think having that shared decision, making discussion with families, really outlining what is the likely outcome of that level of behavioral care versus that along with adding anti-obesity medications.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this brings up some really interesting facts that we just need to keep in mind, that even with the best, you know, behavioral lifestyle therapy that can be offered, the outcomes are not stellar. They pale in comparison to outcomes that we're used to getting now when we used more advanced therapies, including anti-obesity medications and metabolic bariatric surgery. And I think the other thing that is disappointing is that when we follow up these patients 12 months after the completion of these intensive programs where they've devoted, you know, 26 contact hours in a 3 to 12 month period, that after a 12 month period follow up for that, they're back to baseline. Right. So clearly
or worse,
we need,
actually.
yeah, or worse, right. And so, you know, versus, you know, medications where, of course, if you stop medications, there is a potential for weight regain. But that brings up a whole nother point of, you know, how to manage medications. And same with surgery.
Right.
That all
so I
being
think if we dig into those numbers a little bit, just I think we need to start now that we have this data, it's incumbent upon us as providers to share this information when a family comes to us to say, my child has class two or class three obesity. They're perhaps at the 150th, 160th percentile of the BMI. And we need to outline what are their expectations. If we're going to send them to, you know, 26 contact hours, which is the guideline, the BMI Z-score benefit difference is minus 0.17. Okay, so if we outline that, and if we go up to the 52 contact hours, that increases to perhaps significantly meaningful of minus 0.31, which we assume minus 0.25 is significant. So we're going to ask and families to engage in that level of intervention. And as you say, when that ends, what happens? And if you juxtapose that to our prior paper that we talked about on our prior podcast, where we have a table that outlines what happens when you add those medications, phentermine, topiramate, for example, of a, you know, a minus 10% BMI change, or some of the newer anti-obesity medications up to 16% with semaglutide. So we need to be in surgery up to 25 to 30%. So we need to be laying that out for families openly and have them ask us questions so that they're making a very informed decision when they opt for one or the other. And we do need to meet families where they are. They may really want to start with intensive lifestyle therapy, and that's okay. But we need to be guiding them and monitoring them ongoingly. As it says in the CPG and our CPSs, this is a lifelong disease. It's likely to progress. And as you said, the duration of without management, we know that there's consequences not treating obesity with those obesity-driven complications that are starting earlier and earlier.
So at this point, I think we're going to focus a little bit on the use of AOMs in this population of anti-obesity medications. I'm sorry, we keep saying AOMs, but that is our abbreviation for anti-obesity medications. And we're specifically talking about the use of them in the 2 to 12 age group. Now, we have this discussion is caveated by the fact that there just are few randomized controlled trials in this age group. And that is not unique to anti-obesity medication in this age group. When you look at any disease state, there are few randomized controlled trials in this age group. It's just not an age group that is included by pharmaceutical companies when they're thinking of developing medications, being a population that is vulnerable and harder to, in many ways, harder to study in a trial because of the rapid growth occurring during that time. And also the fact that, you know, these patients generally are not able to consent on their own. They may be able to assent, but not consent at a certain age. But, you know, it is a vulnerable population. So in this population, we do in our CPS spend some time looking at drugs that we have one medication that is specifically FDA approved in this population, but then there are other drugs that were used for indications other than obesity, but had weight effects on the weights that we're going to discuss. And then there's another category of ones that were used for adiposity related diseases, insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, that we also discuss in our CPS. So we're going to spend a little bit of time discussing those at this point.
Sure. And there's great tables. If anyone is interested, I would definitely refer you to the tables. This was a great opportunity for us as a writing group to really look at the data. And we have been relying heavily on the AP off-label statement, policy statement that came out in 2014 that outlines exactly what you just said, Dr. Kuda, those limitations to those studies. And I think Fox et al. Had a paper recently that said this is sort of a double standard holding these criteria for children with obesity, and yet many other chronic diseases we're using medications off-label. And I think in our paper, we mentioned up to 30% of all medications prescribed are off-label in the pediatric population out of necessity to care for our patients. And so in our CPS, we have a table 3 that looks at that non-adiposity related diagnoses and some of those medications that may overlap with our obesity management. And some of these looked at children as young as 1 to 2 years of age. For example, topiramate is an anti-epileptic medication that we use for seizures. And this allows us to look at the data in terms of safety and efficacy for something when we're using it off FDA, off-label for FDA indication in population, we can still gather the safety and efficacy data to inform us and have that conversation with our family so that they can know that we are going to be monitoring their child using a medication that is completely FDA approved for other indications. So it's not illegal or improper. And even in those instances, for example, with topiramate or lisdexamfetamine in our table, we talk about for children as young as 6 years of age, 2 years of age, even when within those studies where obesity was not or weight change was not the outcome that they were looking at, they do comment in terms of side effects. And sometimes we saw that. And this is without a specific lifestyle intervention for these populations, because right. That was not the treatment goal.
And without the patients necessarily needing to lose weight.
Correct.
You know, they're not categorized as being obese right. or overweight. And yet right. the effect on weight was significant enough for them to report on it.
Absolutely. And particularly in the FAST et al. Paper, first mean standard BMI change was minus 0.72. So significant, right, for some of those children who may not have had obesity, as you say, and may not have needed to lose weight, but we saw that. And there's another review by Childress that showed a BMI percent change for some kids with lisdexamfetamine at the 20 milligram dose as high as 6.7 and the 37.4%. So that's a very significant, far beyond intensive health behavioral lifestyle therapy. Right. And we understand that. And topiramate, we know, is a medication that is currently FDA approves as a combination medication, phentermine, topiramate for adolescents. But that is a part of the medication, and we understand that. So being able to look at that data in that table, I hope, will be useful to our colleagues when they're educating themselves and their patients and informing them about that safety.
And I think you made an excellent point that when we're talking to our patients about these medications, we're talking from the perspective of knowing what the adverse events are. We're not proposing something that's, you know, not a known quantity. These are medications that we have a lot of experience using in children.
Absolutely.
You know, right. So I think that can be reassuring it's reassuring to providers for sure. And it should be reassuring to parents and patients.
Right. Absolutely. And I know you mentioned for the medications that are used in our practice for patients with the indication for obesity-related diagnoses. And we do have a table looking at that as well. In particular, those medications include metformin, which we've used a long time in pediatrics. It's FDA approved for kids 10 and older. However, we've used it off-label for other indications for younger children. It's another medication that we can use that can help mitigate weight-promoting medication side effects that we know, for example, many of our children under the age of 12 are prescribed antipsychotic medications with significant weight-promoting side effects. And metformin is one of those medications that we've been able to utilize. And Yanofsky, for example, outlined in children as young as 6 to 12 that they did have significant change in their difference of BMI of minus 1.09. And so there are a number of those looking at metformin. We also have some on phentermine. That is an old medication, right? The earliest study that we could find that we added to our table was in 1966.
Yes.
And children as young as 3 years of age where they had significant weight change. So again, we can pull on that older data. Exenatide is another medication that is FDA approved for children with type 2 diabetes from 10 years and older. And also liraglutide, for example, is approved for children 10 and older. So we have that safety and efficacy data that you're talking about, Dr. Kuda, and we outline it in here. There's actually a study by Kelly et al. That looked at kids as young as 9 with exenatide as well that we added in there. And Siebstahl is a really good review that looked at, particularly for kids for 5, our age range, the younger age range was particularly metformin to topiramate. And those kids had significant changes as well.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we've talked about the medications that are out there. And I think at this point, we should discuss a little bit about the different recommendations to use these medications or not by the AAP, the OMA, and the European medical agency as well. Because I think there are some recommendations out there so that practitioners can know that they're not, you know, they're not kind of on their own. So can you talk about those a little bit, Val?
Yeah, so the AAP-CBG, as you said, they do have a consensus statement within their document that outlines, and I quote, the CBG authors recommend pediatricians and other pediatric healthcare providers offer children 8 to 11 obesity, weight loss, pharmacotherapy. And the European Medicine Agency did recommend for children as young as 6 years of age who have severe obesity. So in our CPS, in our pediatric algorithm we do talk about that and guide you in terms of feeling secure in the data that is out there and how best for you to find that as you are exploring and expanding your experience working with patients with obesity. So that does exist for sure.
Yeah, and I think one of the important points we try to make in our CPS is that this decision is a shared decision-making decision, regardless of age. The patient, it can be deserving of treatment at any age. It should be determined by the amount of pathology that can be anywhere from, you know, our typical comorbidities that we do to behavioral pathology, and also just family dynamics. So this is, it's really the art of medicine here that we're talking about when we're treating these kids. But, you know, I also think that treating these kids is rewarding. So I don't think that practitioners, that clinicians should be shying away from this age group. In fact, just the opposite. And that's kind of why we're doing, why we put out this CPS, why we're having this podcast and discussing it.
Absolutely. If we can have the patients and families understand that this is not their fault and we can describe this disease based in its biology, and if we do that and couple our understanding of how these medications work, how they target those areas of dysregulation, then that engagement, not only from our colleagues, but from the families themselves who might be saying, you know, should I be putting my child on a medication? Is this going to be forever? So all of those questions come up. But if we can be informed about how these meds work, why we're using them, and their safety, then that shared decision-making process can occur and be much more effective. And then it becomes very rewarding, for sure.
And I think the other thing we need to talk briefly about is the use of setmelanotide, which is the one FDA-approved medication for the treatment of obesity at the age of 6, you know, but only for a handful of rare causes of genetic obesity. It's still remarkable that we do have approval for this medication, which, you know, has been shown to make a huge difference in the lives of the children with those rare causes of obesity. And it's a step, you know, a step forward in terms of treatment, and kind of paving the way for other, you know, other drugs.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the clinical trials, right, that they've been doing are expanding, and they are, there is a current study for setmelanotide in different subgroups, hypothalamic obesity, for example, some of the heterozygous variants. So expanding that use. And also now there is a study for kids 2 to 6, under 6. So that age range, right, even younger for setmelanotide, to expand that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, very, very exciting stuff coming down with that. So let's turn our discussion to other research that's out there. What's in the clinical trials right now? Because this is so exciting. We're so ready for more things. So go for
it. It's growing all the time. So we do have a table dedicated to exactly what you're asking about, Dr. Kuda, which was super exciting to even be able to work on this and put this in one place. And it's expanding even as we're writing this paper, right? But specifically for our younger age ranges, which is what we're talking about for this CPS, Scale Kids, for example, is liraglutide study for kids 6 to under 12. So that is ongoing and recruiting. Step Young is for semaglutide for kids 6 to under 18. So that data will be forthcoming, which I think is going to be incredible for us to be able to think about looking at that data, providing us more information about that safety. And when you look at the secondary analysis in the STEP Teens paper, for example, for semaglutide, those kids actually had less GI side effects compared to the liraglutide study. So again, being able to share that with our families and have more tools. Tirzepatide, which is a GIP-GLP-1 dual agonist, is in phase one for obesity for kids 6 to 11 and 12 to 17, as well as some type 2 diabetes research for kids 10 to 18. So that's going to be coming. Again, and more recently, we're just seeing some of the phase 2 and 3 trials for the double and triple agonists that we know are promising in adults. And hopefully, as you said earlier in our podcast, being able to provide the opportunity for our pediatric trials earlier, not waiting 7-8 years after we have adult approval to be able to look at that in our pediatric population is what we're hopeful for and will be very encouraging. So what we see, some of those newer combination medications are really getting to have a BMI change that is really rivaling metabolic bariatric surgery. So we put all of them in the bucket, right, for tools. And our families can make the decision about what's best for them. Also, when we consider those obesity-driven complications, the severity of the disease, and which intervention will be most efficacious for that patient in that moment.
Yeah, and I think that you touched on something really interesting and important. And also what I have found practicing medicine, obesity medicine over the years, is that children tolerate these medications very well. The side effects in children, I mean, it's you do obviously have to counsel about side effects. We want to prepare our kids and our parents for, you know, what to expect. But in my experience, I have and I treat adults also, I have a lot less problems with the kids and really great outcomes. So, I'm hoping that that this is just, we're just like at the tip of the iceberg now, and it's just going to get better and better. So just to summarize here, I want to thank Dr. O'Hara Bao, my colleague and friend, so much for being on this podcast with me and also for collaborating on our CPS, because it really was a work of love and torture. And, but, you know, we do have a growing health crisis here with the disease of obesity, and the prevalence in our youngest patients is increasing. We have new FDA-approved medications for the child with obesity, and outcomes that we need to explore, because our outcomes with intensive health behavioral and lifestyle therapy, they're marginal at best. There's more clinical trials in process, and even more are needed. And then each clinician should manage the child and the family individually using shared decision-making to come up with a treatment plan. So thanks, Val.
Thank you for having me, Suzanne.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.